are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, September 18th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor of Psychology at the University of Michigan, Daniel Keating, on Born Anxious, the lifelong impact of early life adversity and how to break the cycle. Also on the program today, Graham Cassidy will destroy Medicaid and all our patient protections, and then some. And it may pass. Also on the program today, St. Louis explodes in the wake of another cop walking away after killing an unarmed black man. White House lawyers are fighting with each other as Mueller gets Facebook data. And is that the nexus of collusion? Lawmakers vote to make California a sanctuary state. And it's a Republican wet dream. The Trump administration wants to shrink national monuments and parks. And by shrink, we mean just commercialize, privatize. Also, we're threatening North Korea again. Little guy. Little Rocket Man. That's what I call him. Rocket Man. Crooked Rocket Man. Crooked Rocket Man.
In between that tweet and turning next to somebody and saying, Elton John was at Mar-a-Lago. How many seconds?
Maybe 30. Simultaneously.
Yeah.
I could, it's a twofer. I could make him think he's Elton John. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. As you can hear, Michael is back. He's decided to show up for work today. I don't exactly sure why.
Neither am I.
You just got confused at the beginning of the week. You just forgot.
Well, it's sort of traveling and doing business sort of can confuse my pre-planned sick schedule.
Right.
So I'll be back on for the rest of the week.
Michael, I already checked in with the company infirmary today to lay the groundwork for him to be sick later in the week.
Oh, no worry. We have a little Graham Cassidy right here in this office.
Matt.
Yeah, great job.
I don't know what that means.
You don't provide good health care.
Oh, that's true.
Yes.
The infirmary, every time I hear from the nurse at the infirmary here, and she just calls, just laugh. Michael's here again. That's it. Click.
Very gender normative, Sam.
What?
Why can't the nurse be a guy?
Well,
in your fantasy.
Of course she can be.
Oh, okay.
She can be whoever she wants to be. She just, I don't.
Very good recovery.
Thank you. We are threatening North Korea again, because why not? And in fact, here is Donald Trump. Here is Donald Trump. He spoke with President Moon, or I should say, I spoke with President Moon of South Korea last night. Asked him how Rocket Man is doing. Long gas lines forming in North Korea. Too bad. So, yep. I don't think he gets what the Rocket Man was supposed to be. Not somebody who launches rockets, but somebody who goes up in rockets. And I wonder if President Moon was like, I'm sorry, what? Rocket Man? Who's Rocket Man?
You always imagine the faces between any head of state and their translators.
Yeah.
When he's on a conference, well, when they're on a call with Trump.
Cultural references between our country and Asia are so easily like translated anyway that Trump saying Rocket Man, I'm sure, made plenty of sense.
That probably at this point, actually, everybody's used to it enough that Moon was like, oh, he's making a lame Elton John reference. Yes, he's doing fine.
Well, maybe the translator could have just been like, I don't know, it's like Superman? I'm not sure. Like maybe... like the Flash, they doesn't know.
He's saying that he's like Flash Gordon, Mr. President. Okay, whatever.
Click. Let's get the real president on the phone. Is Mattis there? So that's a nice way to start off a Monday. I was wondering, because we hadn't heard of any North Korea launching of any rockets, so Trump was like, I'm going to fill the void. Folks, you want to look good in your underwear and be comfortable, correct? Presuming people see you in your underwear. But even if they don't, you want to feel comfortable. That balance is hard to find. Well made from a sustainably sourced, naturally soft fabric that is 3 times softer than cotton. Go ahead, Matt. What's it called?
Modal.
That's
micro
right.
Modal.
Modal.
MeUndies is the most comfortable pair of underwear you will own. MeUndies has diamond seam pouch that cradles your jewels, as it were. Gives you the support you need without feeling too tight. And both men and ladies will love the soft, eco-friendly fabric. 100% satisfaction guaranteed. That's basically Kelly got her order of MeUndies. And then split, I think. That was basically it. It's possible that she may have left like 6 months earlier if she had gotten the MeUndies before then.
Take the undies and run.
Exactly. Right now, MeUndies has an exclusive offer just for my listeners. Get 20% off your first pair plus free shipping. Don't forget about that 100% satisfaction guarantee. If you don't love your first pair of MeUndies, you get a full refund. This is a no-brainer, folks. 20% off. Free shipping, and 100% satisfaction guarantee. What are you waiting for? If you've never tried Modal, you can catch up only 3.5 years, right?
No, 2011 was when I first started wearing Modal underwear.
I think that the arrogance increases each read.
I mean, I just like to be accurate.
It's the accuracy. Folks, you can only be 6 years behind the curve, Matt's curve.
Accuracy is arrogance.
We're all just like 6 years away from reading books at 3.5 speed. Just go to MeUndies.com/majority to get 20% off. Free shipping and 100% satisfaction guarantee on the best, softest underwear you'll ever own. That's MeUndies.com/majority. This is a limited time offer. What are you waiting for? Start wearing the best underwear of your life. It's changed my life, ladies and gentlemen. Well, I've changed my underwear. It's time to let MeUndies change yours. Go to MeUndies.com/majority right now. Do we have time to play this? Let's do this. It is the 70th birthday of the CIA. And what better way? I mean, I love how, like, you know, the CIA, you know, we just had an example of Google a couple of weeks ago. Basically causing an anti-monopoly group program within a think tank to have to spin off. We saw the CIA, which apparently provides some funding or some support for the Kennedy School at Harvard, get them to fire, or I should say, rescind the invitation to Chelsea Manning for her fellowship. And I'll tell you something, I can barely wade through all of the Dave Rubin tweets about it. He was so enraged about the cutting off of that First Amendment rights. But nevertheless, it is the CIA's 70th birthday. And what better way to celebrate the 70th birthday for Donald Trump than posting a speech he gave to the CIA in his first days in office that was roundly criticized and actually was the beginning of, like, I think people just saying, like, is this guy, he's not sane. It wasn't just an act. And in fact, you're going to hear a lot of cheers on this tape, but it came out subsequent to this speech that the Trump administration had brought basically their own people over to clap and laugh, to make the president feel good or be perceived as being supportive of the CIA. Here is his tweet and his video.
This group is going to be one of the most important groups in this country toward making us safe, toward making us winners again, toward ending all of the problems. We have so many problems that are interrelated that we don't even think of, but interrelated to the kind of havoc and fear that this sick group of people has caused. So I can only say that I am with you 1,000%. And the reason you're my first stop is that, as you know, I have a running war with the media. They are among the most dishonest human beings on earth. And they sort of made it sound like I had a feud with the intelligence community. And I just want to let you know, the reason you're number one stop, it is exactly the opposite. Exactly. And they understand that, too. I love you. I respect you. There's nobody I respect more. You're going to do a fantastic job. And we're going to start winning again, and you're going to be leading the charge. So thank you all very much. Thank you, beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you,
all
beautiful.
Very much. Have a good time. I'll be back. I'll be back. Thank you.
I'll be back.
You know what he sounds like he's leaving the apartment after a one-night stand. Yes. I'll definitely call. Thank you, beautiful.
Oh,
that was amazing. It's a big part of my life. Definitely back on the road for everybody winning again. Thanks so much. Is my sock there? Bye.
Unbelievable. There it is. Donald Trump wishing the CIA a happy 70th birthday by reminding all of us of the horror. In some ways, it just feels like we just could just like we hit one day where we just keep playing over the last 9 months over and over again, right? Like it's just an endless cycle. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Daniel Keating, professor of psychology at University of Michigan, about Born Anxious, the lifelong impact of early life adversity and how to break the cycle. I'll take a quick break. Be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Daniel Keating. He is a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan and author of Born Anxious, the lifelong impact of early life adversity and how to break the cycle. Welcome to the program, Daniel.
Thank you very much.
All right. So explain to us, I mean, the fascinating thing, I mean, we don't have a lot of psychologists on the program because We tend to deal with phenomena that is more sociological or political or economic, but this has great bearing on, and it sort of works both ways, doesn't it? When we talk about this in terms of its implications for our society and the way that society implicates this psychological problem, I guess, or biological problem. But let's start with, what do you mean by anxiety?
Sure, and I'm using it in this context and in the book as a more kind of everyday notion of anxiety, roughly the same thing that we think of as being stressed out or overwhelmed or distraught, distressed, that kind of thing. There is, of course, in psychology, a formal definition of anxiety, which has to do with clinical problems, you know, like anxiety disorder, and that's related, but that's not what my primary focus is here. I'm talking about kind of the level of everyday stress that many people experience and feel, and as I explain in the book, more people are vulnerable to that high level of stress because that high level of stress has a lot of consequences for life, their life, over the whole lifetime. So beginning in infancy, and I cover it from infancy through into adulthood, it makes them vulnerable to all kinds of problems, behavioral problems, health problems later in life, and so forth. So that's the notion of stress that I'm talking about here, and particularly the biological component comes in as those circumstances that can occur very early in life that lead individuals to be what is called stress dysregulated, that they have great difficulty in dealing with stress and are not able particularly well to cope with the stresses of everyday life or the elevated stresses that we're facing currently.
Okay, so in the broadest of layman's terms, what happens in what you're writing about here is that in utero and in early early child development, there can be mutations of genes as a function of the stress of the environment or the mother on a child. Is that right?
Right. That's essentially correct. The one thing is, it's really not a mutation. It's known as it is what's known as an epigenetic modification. So, what epigenetics, which is a pretty new field of study, certainly as it comes to humans, means that there are events that can occur, and they can be stresses in the sort of social sense, which connects with the more sociological analysis I have at the end of the book. But it also can come from other kinds of things like physical exposures, some of which, of course, are socially patterned too, like exposure to lead or other kinds of things. What happens biologically is that it doesn't change the actual DNA in the individual. What it does is that it creates a biological change that can either silence a particular gene or overactivate a particular gene, and that particular gene then has consequences. So it's not actually, it doesn't actually change the DNA, but it does change the way the gene works, which for that individual is essentially the same from their point of view. Whether that gene is functioning properly doesn't matter, whether it's not functioning properly because of a mutation or because of a later epigenetic modification. Yes, but that's the basic idea, and the particular focus in this book is on what is, you know, sort of been the most studied in humans and can conveniently be referred to, I think, as the stress gene, which is the gene that is primarily responsible for turning off your physiological stress response, right? So this is the fight-or-flight response. Cortisol plays a major role in that fight-or-flight response. And if you change the way that gene functions, then your ability to shut down that physical response after some danger has been confronted or dealt with or some threat has been dealt with, we all respond to danger, threat, perceived threat, with the same kind of physical manifestation, physical mechanism, this HPA axis cortisol response that gives us that kind of agitated, got to get something done kind of feeling to try to relieve that feeling of stress. And often that's very useful because we do what we need to do to deal with the world. But for these individuals who are what we call stress dysregulated, they're not able to turn that system off. So they stay at a very high level of this kind of stress, distress, anxiety feelings a lot of the time, which is what then has the cascade into their behavior, their interactions with others, and their health.
All right. Before we get to that, the sort of the patterns of outcomes that you get from this, so this can happen. This basically breakdown in the regulator of these genes, right? That turns them
exactly
off and on. This can happen both in utero, and it can happen like when you're a newborn, or is it just within your utero?
No, it's we observe it both. It has been observed both in utero, and obviously that's if the expectant mother is highly stressed, and that then leads to an excess release of cortisol in the mother's system, and if it gets high enough, it can penetrate into the uterus. That excess cortisol is picked up by the fetus. And essentially, it's a signal to the fetus. You know, we haven't nailed the evolutionary story totally, but basically, the idea is that higher than expected concentrations of cortisol, or really any cortisol, in the uterus, signals to the fetus that it must be a dangerous world out there. Things are problematic. So in a sense, this change is potentially adaptive. It's telling the fetus that when you get born, you're going to be born into some kind of a threatening, dangerous, difficult world, so you better be on alert the whole time, right? You start off being on high alert. That also, though, can happen in the first, roughly the first year of life. There are some studies which, I mean, we can't precisely target it, but that's the high sensitivity period. And the reason for that is essentially the same, that that parents are presumably stressed or caretakers are stressed. They're not able to provide the kind of warm, contingent responding that infants depend on. And again, that serves as a signal to the infant that things are difficult, things are dangerous, there are threats around, and you need to be able to kind of be on high alert. The shorthand for this is the signal to the infant or to the fetus is you better live hard and live fast because there's a good chance you're going to die young. So you better get out there and be on alert 24/7.
I mean, it's almost as if you leave the baby in, it's being raised in, by a pack of wolves on some level, and realize like the baby's almost feeling like it has to be feral. I mean, not obviously, articulating this, but it's as if the system is saying you need to respond to a very difficult situation. I guess I'm just restating
a potentially threatening world, and it's somewhat it is a little bit fine tuned. I mean, one of the interesting studies that came out recently looked at infants who were born to women in the Congo, and all of them, in a sense, are in stressful situations, or virtually all of them live in conflict zones. But it differed; it was present more than one would expect. This change, this high alert stress system, if you will, was present for virtually all of the kids that were born in those conflict zones. But if they were born in a conflict zone and their mother had personally experienced some traumatic events, sort of related to that conflict, right, that they would then, they were in the midst of, sort of exposed to violence, may have been raped, that kind of thing, those individuals showed even more of that pattern than others. So it's in a sense, it's not a completely all or one system. It's that if you're exposed to these sorts of things, you'd be better off. And of course, you can see how in many of those situations, it could be adaptive, right? If you're going to be in a conflict zone, it's probably a good idea to be on alert all the time, right? To run away at the sound of something that might be alarming, or to expect to confront danger. So it is adaptive in that sense. In our relatively less stressful in the direct violence or conflict sense in much of the sort of wealthy Western world, it's primarily a disadvantage to have that, because you're then generating this big response all the time, which has these down cascading consequences we mentioned.
And so there is an age essentially where you've passed the threshold of being susceptible to this, if I understand correctly. And it is also one of those things that, like, once you break the regulator, the regulator's broken. It doesn't matter if at age two, all of a sudden, you're living with caretakers who are completely stress-free, or what happened? I mean, in terms of, like, structurally, what happens during that time? Like, once this happens, are you basically, that's basically it? There are mitigating things that we can talk about, later, but in terms of the structure, in terms of that regulator, it's gone. Once it's gone, it's gone.
So far as we know, that appears to be the case. Now, obviously, research is ongoing, but at this point, we don't know any way to recalibrate that specific system in these circumstances. As you mentioned, of course, there are mitigating circumstances that provide us the opportunity to overcome it or work around it or soften it, but they don't appear at this point to actually change how that underlying system works. They provide us with ways to, as I say, kind of work around the issue and become more resilient about this difficulty later in life, and not only at age two, but you know, into adulthood, there are ways of finding mitigation for it. But the fundamental system, so far as we know, does not appear to then change the way it's calibrated, change the, its basic way it works.
And is there an age where you're sort of clear? In other words, if you in utero and in that first year, you're in an environment where there is not a lot of stress, but maybe by the time you're age four or five, it comes back. I mean, it's one thing to say that your behavior would be implicated and you would learn patterns of behavior, as opposed to at age four or five, that stress regulator could actually get broken.
Yeah, at this point, it doesn't seem to be the case. So if you have... if your system, if this HPA axis, this feedback network that keeps it under control, is working, it would appear to continue to work. Now, having said that, of course, you can overwhelm any system if you put enough stress on it, right? So that you know, if you are getting constantly stressed all the time, you may have a perfectly typical functioning stress system, but you've just got so much stress you can't deal with it, right? So, I mean, it's not as though you've got a free pass for the rest of your life. You can overwhelm the system. And I think this is a basic, you know, thinking about this, it's important to keep in mind there are two basic ways that you can get this hyper-stress situation that is so bad for us. One is this vulnerability that we've been talking about, right, and this epigenetic pathway that leaves you vulnerable for having those high-stress responses. The other, of course, is exposure. How much stress are you exposed to? And one of the things that we know from other research, not this biological research, is that our exposure to stress has been substantially increasing, and particularly we have good data in the U.S. over the last 3 to 4 decades, it has been expanding, the exposure has been increasing considerably. So it's two pieces to it, right? How well does your coping system work, and then how much stress are you getting exposed to?
Right, but in the latter case, if I was to eliminate stress and did not have this problem with the way that my genes are reacting, theoretically, right, I would be fine. In the former case, I would actually have more problems in some ways because I'm reacting to stressful situations that doesn't exist.
Yeah, absolutely right. So if you have this kind of dysregulated stress system, you may need a very modest exposures, just normal everyday exposures, right? I mean, we all have our stress system is working all the time. It's the thing that allows us to deal with challenges that we face in our life. In fact, it's the same system that gets us up in the morning and says, you better get going and do something, right? You're going to need to eat or whatever, right? So it's a normal system. For individuals who have the stress dysregulation, it is frequently the case that there may not be anything other than normal stress or even lower levels of stress, but it still triggers this higher, heightened and difficult to control stress response. So, and it depends, of course, on the time of life. Teens tend to show higher levels of stress response normatively in general because they're dealing with challenging situations that they've not dealt with before, but because they can also, in their minds, generate stressors. So they ruminate at night about how did the social scene go for me today. If you have one of these dysregulated stress systems, that then can cascade and just kind of keep you awake all night worrying about these, you know, your social interactions during the day. And all that time, you're pumping out the cortisol that's problematic for all the other reasons in terms of behavior and health.
So, and I want to just get one more aspect of this before we sort of broaden out as to the other implications of this. But my understanding is that you can then pass on once this you have this the breakdown
modified of, gene
this modified
right.
gene you can pass that on regardless of what your life. I mean, I assume with that modified gene, you're going to live a stressful life, even if there aren't circumstances that would necessarily be stressful for other people. And then you pass on this modification genetically.
That is right. Epigenetically, we would say, but yes, exactly right. So, so that in a sense that there's increasingly good evidence that some of these epigenetic modifications, and this is one where it appears to be true, you can pass that on to the next generation. And so, you know, this is an interesting challenge in biology to the whole notion. There was a big fight between Darwin and Lamarck. Can you inherit acquired characteristics? Well, the answer at that point was no, not, you know, giraffes' necks don't get longer because they're trying to eat high trees. That's not the case. But it does now seem that you can inherit certain kinds of acquired features, if not characteristics, and some of those features have to do with something like a modified gene for how your stress system works.
So do we have a sense of, like, what happens to groups of people who are subject to some type of massive acute stress? The potato famine, slavery,
right.
You know, the genocide.
Right.
Do we then see, like, generations of people who are reacting to that first stress situation? I mean, is there any way to measure that? To track this?
Yeah, there are some interesting notions. Yeah, that is the implication. That is an implication. And there is some evidence to support it. In fact, interestingly, in the New York Times this morning, there's a review of a book on epigenetic inheritance of descendants of Holocaust victims. Survivors, I should say. And so there is increasing evidence that that could be the case. What is an interesting paradox, of course, is that if that were true, because most groups at one time in their history have experienced pretty severe trauma, why is this not a universal characteristic? And the answer would be is that it seems to be something that can be reversed generationally when you have an extremely nurturing environment, both in utero and, let's say, in the first year of life. That if you kind of come with it, if you will, this modification, it does appear that it's super nurturing during that infant period in particular, may well enable the individual to shift it around. There's less clear evidence for this in humans, but it certainly we're beginning to see some evidence. And you know, that fits with the, you know, if we look at the long arc of history, it is the case that we tend to be a bit less violent, less likely certainly to die a violent death than we were eons ago, you know, our ancient ancestors. And so there must be some way that it happens, and that's probably what it is. So it's not permanently etched into a group, but it certainly can carry on over time. And if anything like the existing stress continues, it may very well be the case that you get a larger and larger sectors of the population who are in fact having difficulty with this, you know, this ability to cope with stress, with the physiology underlying that coping capacity.
All right, so give us a sense of what the implications are throughout life to this stress dysregulation. And then let's talk about it in that way, because we sure end up seeing it as not just a psychological manifestation of this, but also sociological as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think in terms of what we would see behaviorally and whatnot first, then when we think of this, and it's not a bad, you know, sort of common understanding is pretty accurate about this, is that what we're talking about here is a system that sort of activates the fight or flight response. And the kinds of things that you get when that's overactive is that the fight response is a lot closer to the surface. So things that get expressed in things like hair trigger anger, or the inability to control anger once it's released, the inability to modify or mitigate one's sort of acting out or negative emotions in normal ways in social interactions. And of course, that's going to have a lot of consequences throughout life. It's particularly problematic in earlier life and young children in school, teenagers and so forth, because it certainly sours their ability to have good relationships with others on which their further social development depends. The other side of the coin, the kind of flight response, is that drawing inward, which can then become reflected in terms of depressive disorders or depressive episodes, where the individual is just kind of shutting down, that they find it too threatening, and they're, in a sense, withdrawing, again, with all of the implications for social relationships. Now, that pattern certainly can continue into adulthood, difficulty in forming or sustaining relationships, difficulty in engaging with the world for those reasons, are some of the behavior manifestations. The health consequences are fairly straightforward, in the sense that what we know is that carrying this extra cortisol in our systems over long periods of time start showing up even in early adulthood, and certainly as we get older, a higher proportion of individuals are going to show cardiovascular difficulties, diabetes, obesity, sleep disorders, a whole host of things of stress-related diseases and disorders are connected to this. And interestingly, we are seeing much, much more of that now in terms of what a lot of folks refer to, I think accurately, as a stress epidemic. So that's the behavioral and the health side. When we shift over to the kind of what are the social circumstances, because we might say, well, we're not in a conflict war zone most of the time, right? I mean, there are some very dangerous neighborhoods, of course, where it might be different, but generally speaking, we're not. And I think that the answer that I propose and a different set of data in terms of looking across countries and that sort of thing, I think supports the idea that what we're experiencing are the consequences of increasing inequality. This is, in effect, the new predator. It's not that it's a war zone or a new, you know, lions have invaded our territory or whatever. It's that we're exposed to feelings of being highly stressed out, and kids' parents are exposed to that because of their worries about being able to, you know, sort of get along in the world, for social mobility, for are they going to, in fact, be negatively affected. So I think the source of stress it has changed. The physiological, the behavioral, and health consequences just follow along once you have that high stressor out there.
All right. So is there data as to where you can find concentrations within our society of people who exhibit or have this stress dysregulation? My first thought is that, you know, if I was to go into a classroom, let's say, of fourth graders in Greenwich, Connecticut, versus go into that classroom in Newark, New Jersey, that I'm going to see a higher concentration of kids who have this stress dysregulation. And the implications of that just seem to me to be massive on just your ability to teach class in those situations.
Oh, absolutely. That is the case. And, I mean, we don't have yet population studies of this particular kind of epigenetic modification. It's a bit early days for that. But the things that follow from it, we have excellent evidence for, right? So if we look at things like the disparity in educational achievement, but not just achievement, functioning in the classroom, the disparities in things like what are termed externalizing disorders, which are these hair trigger, anger, acting out, conduct issues, and in fact of internalizing, we see major social disparities along just the lines that you're talking about. We're less in, if I'm a teacher in a fourth grade, I'm probably going to be less attentive to the internalizers because they're just withdrawing and not causing me particular problems, at least in the immediate sense. But if I've got a higher proportion of kids who are externalizers, often can come across as ADHD or attention difficulties, even if it doesn't get clinically diagnosed. So a lot of those things are going to create that. And as any teacher will tell you, there's a critical mass of kids who have different kinds of problems to deal with that are a challenge for them and a challenge for you. When that critical mass, when that number relative to the total group gets large enough, it's very hard to keep the process going because you're spending a great deal of your time trying to just merely manage behavior and don't nearly have enough time left over for the primary mission of teaching and learning.
Well, when will we have that data on this epigenetic, differences amongst the population?
You know, that's a great question. I'm part of a large group. Actually, we've got a national group that's starting work where we're going to be looking at that with a large cohort, a large group of individuals collected in many different sites across the U.S. Where we have data on them from prenatally, from before birth and at birth, and then following them up. So, I think the...
Is there any pools of data out there where you can, pre-existing groups, control groups, or where you can go and borrow the data essentially from and sort of retroactively go back, or no?
The short answer is no. There may be some intriguing ways of trying to get around that particular problem, but you need to have, in terms of understanding how the stress dysregulation of this particular thing happens, you could, in fact, do large samples where you're collecting that information about whether or not they have this epigenetic marker. It's a pretty expensive process to do it, is part of the issue, right? Mm. So you could take existing databases and say, let's add some epigenetic markers to that. And that is starting to happen. I shouldn't dismiss it. I think that we will have some close to population level data within the next 3, 4, 5 years, because there are people who are out there trying to collect that data. But at this point, we can't estimate. So we might see, let's say in a classroom in Newark, we see a high level of kids who are behaving in ways that are consistent with this difficulty in handling stress. There are a variety of reasons, not just this, why that might be true, right? So we can't say, we can attribute it to this particular kind of thing. But in the not too distant future, I think we'll begin to see evidence that we have that. And ideally, of course, to really nail it, we'd like to follow up individuals from before a lot of this stuff happens, looking at them from this early life period and following them forward. And I think we'll probably have data like that within, 10 years or not too long after because we're already following kids from birth for that purpose.
The public policy implications of that are huge. I mean, it seems to me that, if I could go and I could show, look, this is my elementary school in this district, and I have, 20%, 30%, 40% higher number of kids who are dealing with this epigenetic disorder. I'm available for federal grant, funds to deal with this. I mean, it seems to me. I mean, there's
well, right? No. I think the implications are huge, and I think one of my motivations for writing the book is to say, look, we are all, many of us are very deeply concerned about things like economic inequality, income inequality, social inequality in a general sense. But look, this is a kind of inequality that gets under the skin. It gets into your biology, and it's not easily dealt with, right? And so to the extent that we're creating circumstances that embed that kind of biological change in the individual that they're going to carry with them, throughout life and may very well pass on to the next generation. This is not just, let's make the policy change and we can deal with these sorts of things. It creates a burden. It creates a lifetime and multi-generational burden for individuals and the population at large. And so, I think it has enormous implications and a big motivation for me to try to link these kind of molecular changes in the person together with these broad social patterns is to try to help get the message out there that these are very serious issues with long-term consequences.
And so when you are, on some level, it's quite possible that this phenomena adds to things like wealth inequality, right? Because if you have specific communities that are far more stressed, insofar as, and you're also getting far less prenatal care, not just physical care, but also sort of emotional care. And, you're living in a community or a neighborhood or in a circumstance where you have a lot of reasons to be worried about the fact that you have a child and how you're going to pay for it or, how you're going to be able to raise it in this context. If you are, it seems to me then you're creating a cohort of people who are necessarily going to have far more challenges in their life and less of an opportunity to move up the income scale to the extent that there's any mobility left when
right,
we talk about
right,
our
exactly.
society. But to the extent that there is, it's just going to add a bunch more challenges, right? I'm not going to get to go to as good of a school because I may not even be able to finish school because the behavior I'm exhibiting and my capacity to deal with the normal level of stresses that are associated with school and social interactions, I just can't do it.
That's absolutely right. And I think that one of the things that that we see is that those the consequences of that, and again, not attributing everything to this particular one particular change,
right.
but when we look at things like sort of inequality and educational attainment and career attainment and that sort of things, I mean, one of the lines of work that I've also pursued is looking at population comparisons, comparing people in different countries. And what we see over and over again is that those countries that have much higher inequality show much worse problems along these lines, right? And so that we have that the overall performance, whether it's in education or in health, let's say, we see those differences will show up, when we compare, one nation to another and looking even only at, pretty well-off countries. You wouldn't compare it to countries where there's already deep problems of just material resources to begin with. But when we compare wealthy Western countries, for example, we see this pattern over and over again, and it affects it affects education, it affects career choices and opportunities, it affects health, and it affects longevity. We live less long, right? And so the more unequal the society, the younger, on average, people will die. And so it does have those sorts of consequences. And, unfortunately, I think as many of us would guess, and many of us probably do already know, in our country, that's a problem that's getting worse by the decade.
So now, when you examine two different countries, we're talking about industrialized nations, and you see one country, let's call it America, has a high incidence of wealth inequality, and versus another country, some country in Europe, that doesn't have the same measure of disparity. Do you see the implications? Do you see this epigenetic disorder across the income spectrum, or is it isolated? I mean, who exhibits it in a country where you have determined that wealth inequality creates more of this? Where is it
right.
exhibited along the socioeconomic strata?
Very much as you probably would have guessed. That is to say that we do see this particular epigenetic modification follows very much a kind of socioeconomic status slope, right? So the highest concentrations will be in the lowest income, most disadvantaged populations. The lowest incidence is going to be in the highest levels of income and highest economic advantage. So we do have, again, we don't have as broad population
right.
studies as we'd like, but the evidence appears to be pretty clear, and other non-epigenetic evidence of the consequences of this that we would expect to see follow that quite well. The one thing I would put in just to point out, though, is that it's not as though individuals at the highest levels, at the upper 10% or upper, 20% or whatever, are immune to this pattern. So when we look at very interesting study looked at some of the physiological indicators of how much stress you're carrying. So you look at things like, cholesterol level or things that have to do with kidney function or liver function can be measured and have been measured at a population level. What we see is from, the late 1970s to now is that for the whole population in the U.S., that has gone up quite a bit. It has gone up most for individuals at the lowest end, that is, the inequality is getting worse, but it still has gone up significantly for individuals at the higher end, which suggests that we're not, no matter where you are on that SES, ladder, you're not immune from it, right? You may be experiencing adversity for different reasons, that you're worried about things like social mobility, or as parents, even if you feel fairly comfortable that you're going to be remaining well off, are your kids going to be able to do that? That itself can cause stress, or the stress of maintaining the lifestyle where you've got two parents who are super stressed because they're in super high stressed occupations. It may pay well, but they may be stressed all the time. So it affects them less, obviously, than you're worried about where your next meal is coming from or whether you're going to be homeless. That's obviously much higher stress. But no one is immune, at least in terms of where the data show us, both behavioral and physiological data. No one's immune from this.
Right. I mean, you could be really worried about your, like, your boat. So let me just, but now when you measure that, those stress levels, that is a second order assessment based upon physical manifestations of it, right? I mean, cholesterol level, is it possible any of that comes also from changes in our diet when we look?
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. And I don't mean to suggest that every one of those is a direct consequence of this particular modification to the stress gene, but these particular indicators are ones that we know to be related to stress. And in this particular study I'm talking about, they did control for things like body mass index and other obvious things, okay, right, that would make a difference in that. They obviously, you can't control for everything, but some of the obvious ones they control for, and the pattern is still pretty clear.
Now, you lay out in the book measures that an individual can take if they suspect, I guess, that they suffer from this, or they know somebody who suffers from this. I mean, broadly speaking, these are steps that an individual can take to mitigate the implications of not having a regulator, of entering into the fright or flight sort of, I guess, mode. But are there prescriptions for how you deal with large groups of people who might be going through this? I mean, how would, if we do ultimately come to the conclusion that, like, wow, two out of every five kids or four kids, you know, in an elementary school in Newark suffer from this. Are there large scale? I mean, are there solutions that are bigger than just like you kids got to be more mindful. You know, here's a yoga plan. Or maybe it is. Maybe it's just like we're going to do yoga now for an hour. I mean, is there a broader, almost like policy prescription to mitigate?
Yeah, I think there are some scalable implications of this that I think are substantial, and I think, you know, I break it down into two categories. One, which we might consider to be preventive, which is to say that if you want fewer of these, you know, if we want to try to reduce the number of individuals who are carrying this burden at a population level, we need to direct a whole lot more policy attention to individuals who are going to be the parents of these kids. So for expectant parents, and I say parents, not just moms, because, you know, the partners of women who are expecting can help to reduce the stress for the expectant mother, right? So it's parents there, and certainly in the first year of life, it's parents, you know, or whichever caretakers are involved with that individual. And so when we think of large scale prevention kinds of things, there's lots of things that we could do that would make it much less likely, A, for kids to experience that kind of stress that might trigger this, or who could then be potentially moved away from that, even if they've had some prior exposure, even inherited exposure to this. So things like parental leave, things like employment flexibility for expectant mothers. There are policy implications, as well as just general population implications, that are more cultural than policy, which is that, you know, we ought to be, you know, pitching in when it comes to trying to keep that, you know, that system, that very vulnerable system for the fetus and the infant, a more, you know, sort of nurturing, calm, warm, contingent, emotionally positive. So that's the preventive side of it. When we have individuals who are already in that situation, you've mentioned there are individual kinds of mitigators, but all of them actually are scalable, you know, to larger groups. So, for example, I mean, the three big ones that we talk about are number one, positive social connections with others. The second, this kind of more mindfulness, but also making meaning out of the world, using our higher cognitive skills to both be mindful, but also to find meaning in life, which helps on these issues. And then a third is just general physical ways to deal with it, like making sure we get enough sleep, that we exercise, that we eat well. Those are actual biological mitigators of this fight or flight cortisol response. All of those And I had a piece recently on how schools can create themselves as cultures of resilience, right? By focusing very much more on the kind of connections at a real level that teachers can make with kids and that kids can make with teachers. So riding that resilience issue around social connection, which is the best mitigator that we are aware of. But also, I think there are hokey ways of doing mindfulness at a group level or a school level, but I think there are ways, and we're getting better at it, I think, of trying to figure out how to do that for a more widespread thing. And the beautiful thing about this, of course, is that even if you don't have this stress dysregulation, these are good things to be able to do.
Right.
And trying to find ways to make it more possible for more kids to do the kinds of physical caretaking that help. Changing school start times for adolescents, for example, has more than just benefits for learning. It probably has substantial benefits for stress regulation. And so there are, I think it's the same functions that matter, but I think the ways that we achieve them are scalable both by policy and by cultural shifts in terms of what we think is appropriate to do, whether it's in school or the workplace or wherever.
And just as a sidebar, is there any type of medicinal treatments or chemical treatments that there's been research on that will physiologically impact this regulator?
Well, the ones that we sort of know of, we would be hesitating to use them in the general case, right? So
right.
if it manifests the level of what we'd say, oh, this is a gets the level of what we'd have a diagnosis of a clinical condition, whether it might be depression or something along those lines. Yes, obviously the standard medications there, the anti-anxiety, the antidepressant medications, which have to be used carefully and particularly carefully with young people. There are a variety of those things that matter, but I think that what is the case is that we're not likely to try to address this medicinally at a population level,
right.
I think would probably
of
carry
course.
More risks than benefits.
I wonder how many kids are diagnosed with ADHD that may be really a function of these stress dysregulation.
It may very well be a substantial proportion, and I think that'll be some of the interesting research that's going to come out in the next few years. We're going to find out. I mean, it is certainly the case that when we look at groups of kids who have those diagnosed problems, there have been studies comparing them to controls, and they do have a much higher rate of methylation, right? So if we do it at the reverse, right, find the kids who are already affected, are they more likely to show the stress dysregulation pattern? The answer is yes. But there are lots of kids who don't show that, right, who don't show it to the level of being diagnosed, who are nevertheless suffering from a variety of those things and having the consequences at the larger scale.
Well, Daniel Keating, the book is Born Anxious, The Lifelong Impact of Early Life Adversity and How to Break the Cycle. Thanks so much. Fascinating stuff.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right, folks, we're going to take a brief break, head into the fun half of the program. Wherein we will discuss, the fun prospect of perhaps having Medicaid gutted, having our patient protections gutted, having, I don't know what's left after that. the insurance that you've come to appreciate over the past couple of years, depending on what state you live in, pulling apart. So we have that to look forward to perhaps in the next couple of weeks. We'll also take a look at why St. Louis has had now 3 days of protests. Last night, 80 people arrested. Robert Mueller got a bunch of Facebook data via a warrant, if we are to believe the reporting from CNN and the Wall Street Journal. Which may go back to some stories that were around, I think, over the summer about Jared's digital operation. And, of course, California is primed, just waiting a signature from Jerry Brown to become a sanctuary state. All that and more we will cover. And just a reminder, that's really pleasant. Yeah, that dude, Clay Travis. Boy, how did I not know who this guy was? And why do I have to know who he is now? I really wish that didn't happen. But nevertheless, folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can support this program, the free part of the show, the part that you get every day. Maybe you get it 3 days a week. Maybe you just like go and I listen to 4 or 5 interviews a month that I find interesting. You can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you a bunch of bonus material and we take out the commercials. That alone seems like it would be worthwhile to me. I mean, I'm a little bit biased. I'm not going to lie about that. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off of that fair trade coffee. And if you buy your crap from the monopoly, that is Amazon, the very least you can do is give us a kickback by going to majorityreportkickback.com. Majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the link. Use it to buy your Amazon stuff. We get a kickback. Same with jet.com. Somebody told me, I heard this, like Amazon controls 80% of every dollar spent online. And I was told that 80% of that actually comes from their server business. So it's not necessarily like the Amazon store. It is their housing.
Servers for the CIA, for instance.
Servers for the CIA, servers for the Majority Report, as if there was a difference. But it's majorityreportkickback.com, majorityreportkickback.com. All right, 646-257-3920, where we'll take your phone calls. We will take your IMs in the fun half